At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Economics before politics. On the program today, a pleasant housing surprise for you, the same from car makers, and then some swing state economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday. It's the 28th of August. Good as always to have you with us. So I'd have to go back to the archives and check to be sure, but it has been years easy since I've been able to say the following sentence. You ready? Here we go. There was a rare bit of unadulterated good economic news today. Home prices are going up, and it's happening in all 20 of the biggest metropolitan areas in the country. Atlanta, Chicago, even, get this, Las Vegas, all have seen median home prices rise. We know this because the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index told us so this morning. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Take Atlanta. It's been a real estate disaster area. It's faced a flood of foreclosures, from starter homes to million-dollar mansions, driving prices ever lower. Now they're rising, up 4.5% from winter to spring. Atlanta realtor Justin Ziegler was holding an open house today in the upscale Virginia Highlands neighborhood.
This house is completely restored, 5 bedrooms, home theater, carriage house.
Asking price, $1.5 million. By midday, about 10 buyer's agents had already stopped by.
For a rainy Tuesday afternoon, I'm not dissatisfied with that at all.
And Ziegler says move down to homes in the $1,000 to $200,000 range, and realtors are getting multiple offers near the asking price. He says many think it's finally the right time to buy a first home or move up.
First off, the interest rates are phenomenal, and rental rates for apartments have been the highest they've been in about 6 years.
David Blitzer at Standard & Poor's says Atlanta mirrors the other drowning real estate markets in the country that are now swimming again.
The Sun Belt, where all the disasters were, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Miami, Tampa, all four of those cities seem to have turned around.
I asked Blitzer how soon rising prices might restore the housing market to pre-recession levels.
We'd be back to the peak in your lifetime. I want to know how old you are before I answer the question.
Okay, well, I'm 50, so I...
You may make it, don't worry.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
He looks good for 50, though. Mitchell does. All right, moving on. You know those ad circulars you get stuffed in your mailbox by the annoying handfuls? Well, there is a fight brewing over who gets to send those things to you and how many of them they can send. Sabri Benishour has that story.
So what do you do with the inserts, the coupons, the flyers you get in your mailbox?
Before I even walk in my house, I throw it in the recycling bin on the way to my house.
That was Washington, D.C. resident Amrita Ibrahim. But somebody's clearly looking at that stuff because it keeps coming and people are actually fighting over it. The U.S. Postal Service cut a deal with direct mail company Velasys to lower the rate it charges to deliver ad circulars if Velasys agrees to send more mailers. The nearly bankrupt Postal Service says it stands to make $107 million. Meanwhile, the Newspaper Association of America is suing to block the deal. It says the lower rates will allow Velasys to undercut what newspapers charge advertisers for the coupon bundle in Sunday papers. Newspapers stand to lose $1 billion. Charlotte Little is CEO of the Newspaper Association.
This is not going to be helping the post office significantly, and it's really hurting our business. And we just think it's incredibly unfair. We think it's really wrong and anti-competitive.
However the fight shakes out, it's possible you could get more junk mail.
Oh,
it's not. No, it's money. It's like money in the bank.
Jody Meyer Crothers is a star on TLC's Extreme Couponers. She's the one who actually opens the stuff.
I would love more coupons, more of that junk mail coming out.
For everyone else, like Liz Tunick.
It's annoying. It clogs up my mailbox a little bit, but there are many things that annoy me more than junk mail.
I don't know, like maybe the downfall of newspapers or the bankruptcy of the Postal Service. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Go straight into recycling in my house. I don't know what it is about Wall Street, but those folks are just phoning it in this week. Another quiet day in equities. Details, numbers, when we get there. The Republican National Convention is back on track today, and Romney speaks tonight, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie as well. There will be other speeches, of course, parties, gatherings, politicking of all kinds, which translates inevitably into a boon for businesses in Tampa Bay. The welcoming committee down there published a small business directory for its visitors. We got our hands on one and did some calling around to find out what kind of boost 50,000 convention goers can bring. We found in its pages Sabor de Cuba. It's a cigar rolling company in Dunedin, Florida. Tilly Noya does marketing for them. Tilly, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
How's business? I mean, are the Republicans keeping you busy?
Yes, sir. Business, as far as cigars goes, has been very, very slow. Cigars are kind of not a necessity. They're kind of like a little perk that you would have at a private event or a corporate event. And those kind of perks have kind of been dwindled quite a bit. So this has been a very good shot in the arm for us as far as business is concerned, having the RNC here.
So if I wanted to have you come and roll some cigars for me at my event, how much would that cost me?
Well, we have different packages. Like, you know, if you wanted private labels on your cigars with your name on them, we do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I totally want, high end for 100 people and for 2 hours.
And how many cigars?
One apiece.
One apiece.
Does that make sense?
That would probably, you know, run you under $1,000.
Under $1,000.
Yeah,
okay.
No more than $600.
Wow. Now, what kind of tobacco? I mean, what kind of cigars do you guys roll? Is it like premium leaf and all that stuff? I don't even know the jargon.
We use a blend of Dominican Republic. We use some from Nicaragua, from Honduras. And the wrapper, we prefer to use Connecticut, which is one of the best.
I'm sorry, Connecticut? As in Connecticut, the nutmeg state, Connecticut?
Yes. If you ever go to Connecticut, look for the tobacco plantations. They're there.
I didn't know they grew tobacco in Connecticut.
Yes, they do. And it's one of the best wrappers. It's actually the only tobacco grown in the States that can be used for cigars.
Wow. Who knew?
Yeah. You learn something every day, Kai.
Yes, I do. Tilly Noya. She's at the cigar rolling company called Sabor de Cuba.
Sabor a Cuba.
Sabor a Cuba. See, I got it wrong.
Yeah.
Sabor a Cuba.
That means it tastes like Cuba.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Tilly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kai. It was great talking to you.
If somebody mentions the Silk Road to you, what do you think of? Marco Polo and the exploration of Central Asia, right? Yeah, no, that's the same mistake I made. The modern Silk Road is apparently an online marketplace for illegal drugs. Cocaine, ecstasy, heroin, the serious stuff. And a seriously profitable one, too. A new study from Carnegie Mellon says the Silk Road is bringing in an estimated $2 million a month and growing. But riddle me this. If it's so easy to buy illegal drugs online, why isn't it easy to shut that site down? Sally Herships has the story.
Do you remember the Dread Pirate Roberts from the movie The Princess Bride? The Dread Pirate is also the name the customer service rep on Silk Road goes by. It makes sense that he, or she, wants to stay anonymous. But while the site may be illegal, it is still a business. Nicholas Christian is the author of the new study on Silk Road.
It's somewhat surprising how normal the whole thing is if you set aside the type of goods that are being sold.
Silk Road's biggest seller is marijuana, but you can buy gift certificates on the site. Sellers get reviews like the product was great, prompt shipping. Christian says shopping on Silk Road works pretty much the same as it does on eBay or Amazon.
You see something that you like, you browse through different categories and you click add to cart.
But even though buyers do have goods shipped to them through the mail, they don't use PayPal or credit cards. Instead, money changes hands in the form of bitcoins. It's a digital currency that's really hard to trace. The site also uses a software called Tor.
People use Tor because they want to separate who they are from where they're going on the internet.
Andrew Luman is director of the Tor Project, a nonprofit that researches and develops online privacy. He says activists blog revolutions in dangerous countries using Tor.
Maybe you're a teenage girl and you want to investigate, you know, women's rights. And in certain countries, that is threatening action.
Tor's job is to make all its users anonymous. It's one of the reasons Silk Road is so difficult to track. The DEA said it had no comment on the site. And all this secrecy means shopping on Silk Road comes with risk. If shoppers have a problem with a transaction, they can't call the Better Business Bureau. But Nicholas Christian says business at the site is growing quickly.
You have to understand that this is not about ethics. It's just about common sense.
Chris Delarocas is chair of information systems at Boston University.
The fact that somebody is dealing in contraband doesn't necessarily mean that they're less, quote-unquote, honest when it comes to fulfilling transactions. If somebody wants to remain in a market and sell to other people in the future, they have to deliver what they promise.
And, Nicholas Christian says, for consumers who shop at hidden sites like Silk Road, buying online can be safer than dealing with a seller in person. Another reason business on the site is booming. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It got to the point where the prices were just crazy. And while we had a sentimental attachment, you have to make a business decision as well.
The land boom and bust and the sweet smell of citrus in the swing state of Florida. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, more of the dog days of summer for Wall Street. The Dow Industrial subtracted 21 points, not quite 0.2%. The final number today, 13,102. The NASDAQ eked out a 3-point gain, barely 0.1%, 3,077. At the close, the S&P 500 shaved off just a single point, ended basically flat at 1409. Lexmark International is getting out of the inkjet printer business, and investors, it seems, could not be happier. They marked up the stock by almost 14%. All right, so maybe it won't mean much to hear that business is good for PVH Corporation, but if I say the company's flagship Tommy Hilfiger brand is doing well and the clothing maker just raised its earnings outlook for the third time this year, you will then understand why shares of PVH showed up a gain of almost 5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its second estimate gross domestic product report for the second quarter. The National Association of Realtors reports on pending home sales for July. And 7 years ago, Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, leaving devastation in its wake. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Isaac is now officially a hurricane headed for the coast of Louisiana sometime tonight. So weather forecasts and weather people are getting a whole lot of screen time on television right now. But that's only one part of the weather industry working overtime, as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
For New Orleans, there's still only one, and he was the best, WWL's Nash Roberts.
The people east of the river are having high tides now, and it'll continue to rise.
With just a map and a black marker, he tracked hurricanes with a calm, even tone. No graphics, no drama. Nash died in 2010. Right now, on Twitter, you can read posts like these.
I wish Nash Roberts could send us a magic marker forecast from heaven.
Or,
all these spaghetti models tell me is that I really miss Nash Roberts.
But TV was just one part of Robert's job. For more than 50 years, he also predicted weather for oil and gas companies. Private weather consulting is a vast part of meteorology that, even during a hurricane, the public doesn't see. Sarah Croak runs a forecasting firm out of Kansas City.
Weather or not, incorporated.
Companies hire her to tell them if they should send home their construction crews or if the Royals have a home game.
Is the rain a delay or a showstopper?
I asked Palm Beach weather consultant David Spiegler if private clients get to know more than the public.
Well, they don't get a better picture of where the landfall of the storm is going to be, but they do get a better picture of how it's going to affect them.
If the National Weather Service is like a daily horoscope, a private weather service is like a tailored reading just for you. Businesses pay for the minute-to-minute details most people don't care to know. William Brune heads the meteorology department at Penn State. Undergrads there can study meteorology for business.
They learn about economics, finance, risk, so they can talk to MBAs and work with them in a team.
So instead of heading to the weather service or following in the footsteps of great weathermen like Nash Roberts, more meteorologists find themselves doing weather for the bottom line. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Saw this in the Detroit News today that the big three car makers' North American factories are going to be working at 100% capacity by the end of the year, round the clock on three full shifts. Quite a change from just a couple of years ago, as Dan Bobkoff reports.
Flashback to the end of 2008. The auto industry was in a tailspin. The GM plant in Lordstown, Ohio, laid off the majority of its workers. David Green says it felt bleak.
There were helicopters flying over and people walking through taking inventory. We were really under the impression that we were very close to liquidating what we had.
Green is president of United Auto Workers Local 1714, whose members make the Chevy Cruze. He says these days the Lordstown plant employs 1,500 and operates around the clock. Sean McElinden of the Center for Automotive Research says with U.S. sales up 14% this year, car makers will have to make some changes.
They may have to reconsider not only hiring more workers, brand new workers, but also possibly reopening one of the plants they had shut down.
He says the big three closed many factories in recent years, making the companies more profitable, but they could run out of capacity by 2015. And there's this.
You know, we have other problems. They're called Europe.
About half of U.S. carmakers' sales are overseas. McElinden says their European sales are down about as much as domestic sales are up. But those worries don't dampen the mood at plants like GM's Lordstown. David Green says workers have a very different attitude today.
People are pretty upbeat. I mean, we've got a future here.
And that's a remarkable turnaround in itself. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
This being the last Tuesday of the month makes it the day we learn how consumers are feeling about the economy. The relevant number is called consumer confidence from a group called the Conference Board. And not confident at all is a pretty fair summary of today's report. But come Friday, you may hear something completely different about how consumers are feeling from the University of Michigan, which releases something called the Consumer Sentiment Index. I know. At this point, you're saying, Kai, come on. Sentiment? Confidence? What's the difference? And why do I care? Well, here to explain with today's installment of Money Matters, our series about how the news affects our wallets, is Patty Hirsch. He's the senior producer of our personal finance show. It's called Marketplace Money. Hey, Patty.
Hello, Kai.
So, make me smart here, my friend. The difference, please, between consumer confidence, the number out today, and consumer sentiment. Because, honestly, I've been doing this a long time and I still get confused.
Sure. So confidence, sentiment, sounds like exactly the same thing. Consumer happiness, right?
You bet.
But what this is about consumers' ability or willingness to buy stuff.
Okay.
All right. So say a refrigerator.
Yep.
All right. You're thinking about buying a refrigerator. So the consumer confidence questions, the questions that they ask when they're polling people, essentially ask you, are you going to be happy about buying a refrigerator in 6 months' time?
Okay.
That's the kind of the main area that they aim at. The consumer sentiment people, they're asking you how you feel about buying a refrigerator right now.
So I just got a big bonus and I can afford this refrigerator right now. But in 6 months, who knows, and unemployment's still up, meh.
Yeah, gas prices, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, all those things are playing into those equations.
Right.
So it's either the difference is right now or in 6 months' time.
So let's say you're running Patty Hirsch Incorporated, right? And it's a sluggish economy. You're trying to maximize profits, obviously. Which number do you look at right now?
Well, I think I'd be looking more closely at the consumer confidence number. For two reasons. Firstly,
that is the 6 months out number.
That is the 6 months out number. Firstly, because it's a much larger pool. They look at 3,000 respondents as opposed to 500 in the consumer sentiment one. But also because it's all about managing your inventories, right? You want to know how much you've got to be ordering in the future. And if you've got a surplus right now, how are you going to cope with that?
Right, right. Today is instant and 6 months is the macro picture.
Exactly.
This is, the statisticians would say, a statistically significant sample, right? I mean, they're not just stopping guys on the street.
Well, they kind of are stopping
the
guys
really?
On the street. Yeah. I mean, they in the case of the Consumer Confidence Index, the Consumer Board actually does this by mail randomly. So you might get a flyer through the mail totally randomly asking you to fill in this survey.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they do it. The consumer sentiment people, they do it over the phone, and it's also random. They're not using the same people every time. I mean, I rang up and asked the Consumer Board, the Conference Board, if I could
really?
Actually join. Yeah, asked if I could join the join the index, and they said,
that's like self-selection, man. You can't do that.
Well, it's worth a try, right?
Yeah.
So they said, no, you've just got to be lucky enough to get the form in the mail.
Let me get a little jargony on you here. Are these leading indicators? Does it give us a sense of where the economy is going?
Potentially, although these have been a little patchy in terms of their record about predicting how the economy is going in the past. I mean, last Christmas, for example, consumer confidence was way down, but sales went up. So it's not necessarily a particularly good indicator.
Yeah, and that's that whole, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics thing. Right?
It's that whole grain of salt thing.
Yeah, that's right. Patty Hirsch is the senior producer of our personal finance program. It's called Marketplace Money. His book, which is out today, is called Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. Patty Hirsch. Thanks, Patty.
Thank you, Kai.
Florida is, as we've all been told countless times, a key swing state in presidential elections. It's not like the GOP decided to have its convention in Tampa just for the weather, right? Well, one of the swingiest parts of Florida is the area around Interstate 4 in the central part of the state, connecting Daytona on the Atlantic with Tampa on the Gulf of Mexico. It's a region that's had some trouble coming back from the recession and from the thing that helped get us into the recession in the first place, the housing bust. Marketplace's David Gura took a little road trip on the I-4 as part of our coverage of the things that actually matter in this election, the real economy. Today, the first of two stories, Dundee, Florida, a town of 3,500 people smack in the middle of Florida's citrus country, where much of the economic energy has changed from citrus to homes and now back to citrus. Here's David.
At the height of the housing boom, developers thought this little town could become a bedroom community for nearby cities like Lakeland and Winter Haven, and maybe even for Orlando, which is just about an hour northeast of here. Mark Wheeler grows Valencia oranges, those are juice oranges, on green groves in and around Dundee. Back then, speculators were paying so much money for land, Wheeler couldn't say no. He sold two groves.
Put a lot of time and sweat equity and money into them, but it got to the point where the prices were just crazy. And you know, while we had a sentimental attachment, you have to make a business decision as well.
Polk County officials say that since 1989, the county has lost just under 150,000 acres once zoned for agriculture. One of the first developers to get to Dundee was Ron Benzeve. He's based in Orlando.
I received a call from a builder, and the builder asked me if I would be willing to develop lots for them in the town of Dundee. And I did not know where Dundee was or how to find it.
Benzeve did eventually find Dundee, and he put together a 33-acre parcel here. He planned to build about 150 homes, and he put up 50 before the housing bubble burst. Doug Leonard remembers that pop. He used to be Dundee's town planner. During the boom, his office issued 10 to 15 building permits a month. And then
it just dropped off. It just quit.
Ron Benzeve has spent these last few years trying to get out of the development business, trying to get rid of the land here.
We are in negotiations with the bank to try to come up with a solution that makes sense, although right now it seems to be hard to do. And we're trying to find a way to stave off the losses as best as we can.
Benzeve has put up a sign on the side of the road. For sale, 99-lot subdivision in whole or part. That's how I tracked him down. Benzeve thinks the government could have done more to help homeowners and to help people like him weather the housing crash.
I think a lot was left to be desired.
He says he voted for Barack Obama in 2008, but this year he's taking a close look at Mitt Romney. For his part, citrus grower Mark Wheeler does not think the government could have done anything to prevent the crash that altered much of the landscape here in Dundee. Wheeler takes me through downtown, past the citrus packing plant and more orange groves, and then, a couple of miles up the road, he pulls over.
This would be a, you know, perfect example of the land boom, just how quickly things collapsed.
It looks like a field filled with waist-high weeds. It's surrounded by a fence. But among those weeds, you can see pavement. There are street lamps, and there's a big sign that reads, "The Village in Dundee, a retirement community." Wheeler turns onto a bumpy red dirt road onto a grove his family bought in the late 80s.
So I figured we could walk through this one here a little bit.
That'd be great, yeah.
We stand between two long rows of trees. Wheeler says his net worth was cut in half between 2006 and 2011 as land prices dropped. And like everyone I talk to around here, Wheeler tells me he's worried about the economy and the budget deficit, and he's particularly concerned about the gridlock that prevents Congress from taking action on those issues.
I feel like to move forward as a country, we're going to have to get past that, and I think people on both extremes are going to have to realize that the concessions are going to have to be made. That's just the reality of the situation we're in.
Wheeler, who voted for Obama in 2008, says taxes probably have to go up.
The reality is we spent way more money than we should have over the past decade, and neither party can escape that blame.
Wheeler says he's leaning toward backing Obama again, but he's not fully decided. Today, citrus growers like Wheeler are buying back some of the groves they sold to speculators.
What I wanted to show you here was this was actually an abandoned grove that we closed on last November, and there was a tremendous amount of deadwood.
The developer who bought it didn't do anything with the land. He didn't take care of the trees. But Wheeler figured he could save them. He paid workers to prune them back. During the boom, the job would have cost a small fortune. He would have had to match what the home builders were paying. But just as land prices have fallen here, so is the cost of labor. And saving the trees is cheaper than replacing them. In Dundee, Florida, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
David's trip along the I-4 continues tomorrow. The coastal town of Port Orange, its mayor, and what happens when a town has too much growth. You can follow David online. There's an interactive map on our website. He put something like 1,000 miles on his rental car, I think. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today spotted in the pages of the Washington Post. You know how corporate sponsors of big events can get touchy about things they worry might detract from the brand? Well, this happened. Aflac, the insurance company, was throwing a party down in Tampa at the GOP convention with a key dietary restriction. Any guesses what it might be? Come on. All right, here you go. Try this.
Aflac!
Yeah, no duck on the menu. I love that one. All right, we're done. We got to go. Today, the Dow whittled off 21 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 down a single point. We'll call that flat. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Haas and Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.